day later, and he'd extended the car, and he extended the hotel. So that show, I don't know if you're familiar with it at all, but they, what they do, they normally have three people up there, and the MC reads something about one person, and then the panelists ask question of these three, and then each of them pretend to be that person that they're profiling, and then the panel has to guess which one is the real, whoever it is they're profiling. That's been the format of that show for a long time. Unknown to me, they had added something they called a one-on-one. And so then he told me the last time he called me before I went down, he says, the producer has decided to use you on the one-on-one, one-on-one. So I asked, what is that? And he said, well, you will tell two little stories to the audience. One will be true and one will be false. And then a person in the audience plays too. The panel asks you questions, and then the person in the audience decides which of your two stories is the real one. If the person in the audience guesses right, they win $500. And if they don't, I would win $1,000. So that's what he did. And when I got there, he told me what my story was. He told me this. In fact, I was supposed to go into the studio and be briefed, but the airline, as usual, was late. There were terrible connections, and I didn't get there until way late. And so he briefed me over the telephone on what my story would be. And that was kind of fun. So my false story was to be that I'm an inventor. I invented the pop-up turkey thermometer. And the other one is that I'm a stand-up comedian.
So what did the contestant guess?
He guessed that I was the inventor. And of course, I had to have a story made up. I had to tell the truth on the true one side, but I could make up whatever I wanted about the other one. And the panel got to ask me questions. And he had read, so he read to me a little story. He'd read about the man who did invent it. He'd read that in a magazine so that to give me some ideas. And they asked me things like, you know, how come you did this? And I said, well, I was working for Swift and Company as a chemist. No, what did I say? I was working for them, and they came around and asked me to invent something that would make it easier for women to buy more turkeys. So I had this whole story made up. And the panelists, that was kind of fun. One of the panelists asked me, how do you know when the turkey's done? I said, well, when the little red button pops up.
Who were the panelists?
Oh, see, Dorothy Kilgallen, you remember her?
No.
Well, she must be in her 80s. She's been around on these talk shows forever. A very attractive, charming lady, and dressed beautifully. And David Niven's son, I've forgotten what his first name is, a woman who was with a newspaper or a magazine in the East Coast, and I didn't know her. And the other was a man who is a movie star actor who plays the sheriff on, can't remember the name, some series. And he always was sort of the buffoon. He would ask questions that were supposed to be funny or silly. And so.
So they didn't know the.
They didn't know which one was true either. But they were to ask questions, so the man in the audience listened to the responses.
Did you get a chance to talk to the contestant to find out why he didn't believe your story?
No, I didn't. They taped one audience, and they taped five shows, one right after the other. And that was an interesting, too, because all of us who were going to be on for those five shows had to come early. We herded into a big room, and we were given breakfast, and then we were briefed on everything that would occur. The MC was, this is terrible. What history is any good if you don't have names? This charming, charming man who was a football hero, and he was the chairman, he was the MC. And they had it all figured out that he would ask me some questions afterwards that would lead into a couple, three jokes. And we had rehearsals each set, and in the meantime, we were all back in our rooms, you know, in that one big room, and there were interesting people there, absolutely interesting. One of the women who was going on as an imposter on the same show I was told me that she originally was to be an imposter for being a member of Mensa, but then she'd gone to the library and read all up on it before they told her they weren't going to do that, then they were going to put me on the one-on-one. But there are a number of people who make themselves available down there that they bring in to serve on this. Interesting people. There was a man there who was very good at sketching, and he said he created the first Jewish comic book. And he had some there and showed pictures of his comic, his Jewish superhero. There was a woman who had ridden her motorcycle from Florida clear down to the tip of South America. And they called her the Motorcycle Granny, I think. On my show, there was a woman who trained dogs to sniff out people in avalanches. And she had her dog with her. And they had two other young women were there to each pretending to be the same one. And when they disclosed which one was the real one, they let the dog loose. The MC had him, and he went right to his mistress, of course. And on that show also, they had a professor from a community college, I think, who taught history, who was said was known for dressing up in costumes in class to make his points. So they had these three men up there, and they were just, one of them was dressed in underwear, and you know, they all, so I have a tape of it.
Did your family watch from over here in the Northwest?
The day that show was to air on KGW, KGW had decided that very week, well, the show people told me when it would show. It was some long time after I actually taped. KGW decided that week to drop that show. So I had, and somehow I know why I learned this, and so I asked them, and so they taped it for me. KGW did. I called them and told them, and they said, well, we're not showing it, but we can tape it when it comes. So they taped it, and so I have a tape of it. And it was fun.
So it was shown in other parts of the country.
Oh yes, here. Because people started calling me up who didn't even know I was going to be on it, you know. Some of my Mensa friends saying, one of my friends in New Jersey, she says, here I turned on the TV and says, there was Velma Jeremiah up there. So it was fun. It was fun to see the whole process. When we were herded into this big room and then they fed us lunch and, you know. Then after my part was done, I was the third show taped, I think. Then I could sit in the audience and watch the other two be taped. And it was all very interesting to watch how they do it. And then when you see it come on the air and you know what's going on in the background. After the late afternoon, when the panelists were coming on, we were not allowed out of our room alone. If we needed to go to the restroom, one of the young women who worked there would escort us. And that was to be sure that the show wasn't fixed, that we didn't run into one of the panelists in the hall and give anything away. And they were very careful about that because of the scandals that had occurred years ago in these shows. And between each of the tapings, the panel had to go off and change clothes. They couldn't have the same dress on the next day, you know, or the same. So there'd be a little pause, and the audience would sit there. It was interesting to see. So I had $1,000.
what did your family think about the whole stand-up comedy thing that you were doing?
Well, those who saw it supported it, thought it was great. My mother never saw me. My sister, both of my sisters have seen me, and one of my brothers, one brother has not. My son saw me when I was going up to Seattle to appear up there at the Comedy Underground. I was staying with a friend, a former client, and a friend at her condo downtown, and then my son and his wife and his stepdaughter and his sister-in-law and brother-in-law all came. And the lady I was staying with, she brought two friends to that up there. And a lot of my friends still say, when are you going to get back to it? And my sister both of them have seen me, and she says, you shouldn't give that up. You know, she came to see me, she and her husband and son and daughter-in-law came to see me at the La Fiesta. And the La Fiesta, they loved me there. It was really nice. There was I've come back, I did it three times over there as the MC to introduce the paid performers. I didn't get paid for that. And that was fun. One of the women who was at the desk there when I came back the third time, she says, are you going to tell that joke about your grandson? I said, no, I plan to do something else. And she says, oh, tell it. And then I had tapes sent off. Through a women's organization, some woman who was in the Los Angeles area figured she could maybe get me some professional stuff going and wanted to tape. So I taped three times at the Silver Dollar, and I wasn't too happy with the first two at all. And then they said, well, you fill the audience with your friends and tell them to laugh and clap loud. But I finally did send her a tape, and nothing ever came of that. Then I had a call from a woman who said she was a talent scout for Johnny Carson. And she had read about me, and she thought I would make a good interview. So I sent her a tape at her request. Nothing happened. Time went by, and I knew I wasn't ready for Johnny Carson. You know, I knew that, but she had called me. So I sent it. Time went by, and finally I got back this form letter saying that so-and-so, what was her name, something Golden, is no longer with us. We are returning your tape. We don't have a place on the show for you at this time, and thank you for your interest. And I made a lot of fun out of that, too. I said, I think I deserve more than a form letter. Since they solicited me, I should at least have had a personal letter, rejection letter. And then I got, somebody had sent the Argonian article to a television program in London. And it was a show described to me as prime time and similar to Johnny Carson. So then I had this call from London. This man wanted me to go on BBC over there. So we talked quite a while, and I said, well, I don't know. My son told me I was a little too risque to go on Johnny Carson. And he said, well, like what? And I said, well, gee, I talk about condoms, and I talk about orgasms. And he said, send me a tape. So that little song and dance went on for, probably 6 or 7 months that he was going to have me over there and go on this show. He was keen. He said, we're keen to have you. So then I was going over there on a Mensa board executive committee meeting in July of that year. And so I let him know I was going to be there then, and would that perhaps we could work it out then. And he said, oh, yeah, we'll do it. And so he was to call me at my hotel and set the time for our rehearsal or interview. And he never did. But he called me on the last day, and it happened that the Big Eight was meeting there, and they preempted all the time. So I never went on BBC. But it was kind of fun, you know, a little exciting to have a thick fit
to be solicited by all of these.
From halfway around the world, you know.
When was the Oregonian article published?
Must have been early.
Let's see.
Probably early 91, I think. I lose track of time when it's not something I have to keep track of.
What did it say about you?
Well, it was really kind of a story about my life in a way, but it was focusing on the fact that I had been a woman attorney and now was doing comedy. And the woman who wrote it, Susan, terrible. She was a freelance writer, and she spent a lot of time with me. And she came up and watched me perform twice. I didn't even know it when she was there. And decided I would make an interesting article, and then she sold it to the Oregonian. And then she had, suppose, selling one to the to People magazine, too. And People magazine sent a photographer down from Everett, Washington to take pictures, and he spent a whole day with me. He just did all kind of things. And then I got the date of the issue it was going to appear in, so then I started telling my cousins and people. And then Susan called me and said, guess what? The editor just called me and said they preempted it. And that happened, she said. So those are my fleeting little
15 minutes of fame.
15 minutes of fame, yes. But it was fun. Yeah.
Did you make any lawyer jokes?
I never did. And I specifically didn't because the public thinks lawyers are a joke anyhow. And I figured if a lawyer made jokes, they would take it seriously. So I didn't. I never did.
When you were working as a stand-up comic, there's been a lot of talk about how it's been very hard for women to break into stand-up comedy. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, from the little, my very limited perspective, I don't think the audience cares if you're funny. The audience doesn't care. I think perhaps with some of the booking agents, they may still think men are funnier. I don't think they are assessing, you know, just in an open mind. But I had some good times when I really performed well and my material went over. I performed for the Oregon Women's Forum when they hosted the International Women's Forum retreat. We had it down at Salishan, and we had a little show of Oregon. We put on a little show, and I was the MC, and I did my little bit too. That was the most marvelous audience. They were just so receptive, and they caught every nuance. Every line, because even every line that isn't the punchline, mm-hmm. usually there's something behind it. And they were absolutely wonderful. And unknown to me in the audience is one of my former law school classmates. He was there as a date with one of the women. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, well, when they said VJ, he says, I asked him, was that Velma Jeremiah? And they said, yes. He says, I couldn't believe it. He said, when you were in law school, you were so staid. And I missed my very best line. I should have said, well, Fred, I'm too polite to tell you what you were in law school.
Oh. Do you suppose that you might have been attracted to this because, well, you described yourself before as being somewhat timid at times?
I think I've always sort of wanted to make people laugh, but never thought I could. I can remember way back, when I was in my late teens, a particular movie star who was played a bit part. There was a whole series of B movies in which the cast are about four or five people that always played in them. And this particular woman had a deadpan delivery. She could say everything just without ever moving her face. And I thought she was so funny. And I guess I've always kind of wished I could make people laugh, but I never thought that was realistic. I never thought I could. But then in my Mensa group, quite often in local Mensa, they are so witty, mostly people. Those, and they are so quick on the uptake that, that humor got to be just natural. You know, somebody say something in a very serious conversation, and all of a sudden the other person would hear some little dissonance, and all of a sudden you hear these things were flying back and forth. And I found with some of my close Mensa friends, it got so that we would just really, we were having so much fun and laughing so hard. And then I discovered that I could tell jokes I'd heard, not this spontaneous humor, which is the best of all. But if I'd hear a good joke, I could repeat it well enough and not bubble the, and knew how to time it to make the punchline come out. So I had been doing some of that. And but when it came to writing my own material, that was a whole different thing.
I know that this might be transcribed, or it's very likely that this interview is going to be transcribed, and it might be that some people who look at it aren't going to have the benefit of listening to you talk, and certainly won't have the benefit of watching you as you relate these stories. And I'd just like to make it clear for the history that you come across as a very self-confident, self-assured, and certainly not timid individual, so whatever reservations you had about that in the past, or whatever timidity you had in the past certainly has been overcome. I didn't know if, I wanted to make sure that that came out in the oral history, and I know that that's not something that you'd see on paper, and maybe not even something you'd hear on tape.
Thank you, and I think that's true. I think I have worked my way through that pretty much. I think I know my limitations, things where I still should be diffident. But I'm also no longer concerned about that if I open my mouth, I'm going to say the wrong thing.
Do you think that practicing law in any way affected that?
Very much so, because first of all, I had authority. I mean, people looked to me to solve their problems or to advise them on how to do something, and things that I knew because I had studied them, and so I had confidence. I was an authority on that particular whatever it was. And so that built the self-confidence that you knew your stuff. And then, but when you step out of your own field, then you have to begin to think, gee, I don't know anything about this. And you learn. I said, that's why taking the comedy class, you know, I thought it would add to something that I'd sort of had way in the deep, not thinking I had the ability, but wishing I could make people, entertain people. And I worked my way through it. I got my courage up, and I went up on that stage, and it wasn't bad the first time. It got better. The women's group, they were such a wonderful audience, and it just played to them. And in fact, later, the group, we were on a cruise from LA to Vancouver, BC for the spring retreat on the Women's Forum 1 year. And we were on a seminar on the future. And one of the sections was on health and longevity. And the other was on technology and the coming things. And when we'd finished an afternoon seminar on the health, they were taking questions, and the panelists were taking questions and answers, and one of my fans in the audience asked a question, would Velma Jeremiah do some comedy for us? And I said, no, I can't. I haven't prepared anything. And they said, well, sure, you can do some. So the MC said, we'll take one more question while she prepares. So then I got up, and I had some stuff that had to do with health in a remote context. And I was able to lead in, and I did about 4 or 5 minutes there, and it was very well received. And so, you know, it was fun.
You did some traveling to Eastern European countries while you were retired, since you've been retired?
In May of 1993, last year, I went with a group of lawyers, and there were some professors, law professors, and police chiefs, on a delegation through people-to-people program to the Baltic countries. And we could choose which of the three our group would go. I chose Estonia as my principal one. And then we all met back in Latvia and put our heads together before we returned to the U.S. And that was billed to us as that these governments wanted us to come. We would work with the lawyers there for a week, shirt sleeve to shirt sleeve, and then we could make recommendations about their legal systems and their government. It was an interesting group of people from all over the U.S. As I say, there was police chiefs and law professors and attorneys and judges. It was a very interesting group of people, and I enjoyed them, but the actuality of what we were there for didn't prove out. In Estonia, many of the people who met with us from the Estonian side gave the impression they didn't even know why we were there, why we were taking up their time. Most of us in our group felt very, very, we were very disappointed, because I would not have spent the time and the money to make that trip had I not thought maybe I could contribute something. When I went to China with the women's group, which was also people to people, that was sold on the idea to learn about Chinese law and systems. We were not to give them any input. That was fine. We did exactly that. But in Estonia, they were very well along on their way to establishing their democracy, and they were getting set up with their laws that were following a lot on German law and Swedish law, and their economy, their law practice, and everything else. So it wasn't what it was sold to us for, but it was interesting. It's just that I would not have had done it had I not thought I was there to maybe add something.
You also served on jury duty.
Ah. I had jury duty last year for the first time in my life.
This was in Multnomah County?
In Multnomah County Circuit Court. And the overall thing you come away with is, what a waste of time. What a waste of people with this huge, huge jury holding room. Hundreds of people in there sitting around waiting day after day. Then a few would be called to go up to a courtroom for a panel. And it was just such a waste. I don't know any way they can improve it. They have to have people waiting, because they never know how far ahead a judge is going to be ready to bring a jury in. But it was a terrible waste. I was sat on one jury that was it was a condemnation case. The city of Portland was condemning some property. And the sole purpose of the jury was to decide the value of the property, because of course the city and the owner had very wide views on what it was worth. I sat on that jury for 5 days, went out on my first day, but each day you were only on duty a short time. Maybe we'd come up there at 9 o'clock, but the lawyers and the judge was hearing some other motions first, and then the parties were arguing law before the judge, and you sat in, so maybe you'd actually go in the courtroom for an hour and a half in the morning. Then you'd break for lunch, and then the judge would have some more motions, and maybe you'd get back in the jury box for an hour or two in the afternoon. And this went on for all week, and then we were told to come back on Monday. And there were supposedly going to be two more witnesses that were going to talk about value, appraisers. But Monday morning when we came in, the judge came in the jury room and told us that the case had settled. And that is not unusual, of course. What was interesting to me was we were told that we should not choose a foreman and we should not talk about the evidence as we went along between us. But every time we'd come back in that jury room, there was one man who always wanted to start talking about it. And I would always say, we aren't supposed to talk about it. That was interesting, and I didn't mind it. It was interesting to read the opinion in the newspaper story that the attorney for the city advised the city council that he thought the jury was going to come in on a higher value, so he urged them to settle. And how did he know that?